Remember those road signs that used to say, speed kills, slow down and live? Well, little else has slowed down in the 3 decades since traffic planners instituted the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit, and then later, in haste, repealed it. In a global culture that's dominated by the impatience of youth, counted in nanoseconds, and fueled by just-in-time supply chains, everything needs to be done yesterday, since today is no longer soon enough. But just when it seems warp speed has extinguished the present, movements to slow down and savor life's pleasures are springing up in those very cultures most addicted to acceleration. Today on A World of Possibilities, Life in Slow-Mo. We'll hear from two individuals who've slowed their pace, even as they've quickened their creativity and deepened their appreciation for those things that speeding causes us to miss. I'm Mark Summer. Welcome to A World of Possibilities. After decades of turbo capitalism, the global recession has slammed the brakes on a debt-financed economy. Many who'd run their credit lines to their limits and beyond find themselves skidding to a sudden halt. Economists tell us it's the biggest dip since the Great Depression. Lots of pain to go around, and lots more to come. But a closer look at what happened during that epic decade of deprivation reveals a more mixed picture, including some surprising benefits. Filmmaker John DeGraff has studied the social impacts of the Great Depression. Director of the award-winning documentary Affluenza, John now directs Take Back Your Time, a U.S.-Canadian initiative to challenge what he calls an epidemic of overwork, overscheduling, and time famine that threatens our health, our families and relationships, our communities, and our environment. John ambled over to see us at our studios in Arcata, California. A slow-moving, slow-talking man, his manner belies an enviable level of productivity. He laid out some surprising findings about the upside of downturns.
There are certainly a number of trends, but I think the most significant one is the fact that health in the United States improved significantly during the Great Depression. In fact, the lifespan of the average American in the first 4 or 5 years of the Depression, the most serious years of the Depression, actually increased by 6 years. That's the fastest improvement in longevity in American history. And we saw, of course, a lot of positive things, neighbors helping neighbors. We saw things like much shorter working hours for people, spreading work around, which improved health. Social connection was improved, those kind of things. The fact, though, is that that's not just the Great Depression. We see in every recession in the United States a fairly significant improvement in American health. And every time we have a boom in the United States in terms of prosperity, like the period like the late 1990s, we see a decline in health.
You're almost saying that a prosperous or at least an affluent economy is bad for your health.
Well, in the United States, it's not as good for your health, believe it or not, as a depression. I mean, health actually can improve slightly during positive periods because it's always going actually a little bit. But in comparison to other times and to other countries, health gets much better during recessions. And if we look at certain things like the unemployed, the people who lose their job, it's really a mixed bag. Some of those people turn to alcoholism. We see more spousal abuse. We see an uptick in suicide, not a good thing for the people who lose their jobs. But some of them actually use the time to do things they haven't done in a long time. Exercise, reconnect with their family and friends, go back to school and start learning and getting excited about other things, for example. And more importantly, what happens in the aggregate, that is with the large bulk of the population, is that people work fewer hours during recessions. The result of that is that people do have more time to exercise and less money to spend. So they tend to eat at home more, they garden more, grow some of their own food, they connect with friends and families more in their time, sometimes because they need to, even for the financial support. But it's healthy to connect with other people. They drive less and they walk and bicycle more. Bicycle sales are up, car sales are down. Part of the result of driving being down is that traffic accidents have dropped tremendously. So we've seen a 25% decrease in traffic fatalities in the United States since the recession began. One of the other side effects of driving less is that we produce less air pollution. And factories not operating at full capacity also produce less air pollution. So the result of that is that we're seeing fewer respiratory illnesses, fewer children with asthma, these kind of things. So there are some really positive things that come from this. And when I say that, that doesn't mean that I want to see the unemployment rate go up or that we shouldn't begin to end unemployment. But what it means is that as we go back to full employment, that we think about the gains we've gotten during the recession in health, and we don't destroy those, that we actually go back to a period of higher, more full employment, give people jobs by shortening work hours and sharing work rather than just expanding the amount of work that we have to do.
All of this involves slowing down. During economic recessions or depressions, people travel less, they travel less far, they travel more slowly by usually less on airplanes, more in cars, as you say, even more on bicycles. How much does slowness have to do with increased good health?
Oh, I think it has quite a bit to do with it, because one of the things we know is that stress, whether from overwork or the simple fast pace of our life, the franticness of our life, is not good for health. Sarah Speck, who's a cardiologist in Seattle, a very prominent one, has called this kind of work stress and pace of life stress the new tobacco. And she has a great PowerPoint in which she shows what happens to your arteries under this. And it's pretty much the same thing as happens to you if you smoke too much. So, absolutely. The pace of life has to do with this, and the high pressure, the long working hours really add to that in many ways. They certainly encourage our use, for example, of fast food, which is a response to a pressured, harried way of life, and of course not very healthy for us. We know that. They certainly mean that we do exercise less, for example, and most importantly, probably we socialize less. It's the lack of social connection that is so essential in terms of poor health, and it makes us less happy, which is something I'd love to talk a little bit more about later. But I think this social connection is huge. As Americans have worked longer and longer and spent so much of their lives in personalized consumption and things like that, they've spent less time in connection with friends and family. That's a big health impact.
And of course, with the digitization of culture, these so-called connections of Facebook and other such things seem to me, at least, to be rather disembodied.
Well, I think they are. You know, like anything else, I mean, they can be used for good purposes and not so good purposes. And we are, as a country, just – this is one of the things that didn't come out enough during the healthcare debate. In my view, the big problem with the healthcare debate was that it was about healthcare. That sounds like a non sequitur, but really – we don't do healthcare for healthcare. We do healthcare for health. I mean, if you ask yourself, what would you rather do, spend the next year in the best hospital in the world free of charge, convalescing from illness, or spend the next year at home healthy? I mean, I don't know anybody who's going to tell me they'd rather spend that time in the hospital. So the goal is not healthcare, no matter how good the healthcare is. The goal is health. And the fact is that we spend twice as much as anybody else does in healthcare, and we have the worst health outcomes. And this is what we need to be concerned about. If you live in the United States, you have almost double the chance after age 50 of contracting chronic illnesses like heart disease, high blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, all of those things than you do if you live in Europe. Now, that adds enormous cost to the healthcare system. And that is a direct result of the fact that we Americans work a lot more than the Europeans do, and that our lives are more stressful and less secure than European lives.
What's the relationship between going slower and being happier?
Well, you know, I think what we see when we do surveys of people is that the highest amount of dissatisfaction consistently in countries like Canada and the United States among people when we do happiness surveys, for example, comes in the area of time balance. People feel that they are pressured all the time, and that takes away from their happiness. There's a sense that they can't do the things that they want to do. There's a sense of being less free. There's certainly less time to be involved in those social connections, which are probably the most important thing you can do for happiness. So the link is clear. There are more things one could go into.
You've been involved in Seattle, your hometown, in a happiness initiative that was partly inspired by, I believe, what the Bhutanese government has gotten into, this gross national happiness index. First of all, tell us about what happened in Bhutan and then what you did in Seattle.
Sure. Once upon a time in an exotic country of snowy mountains and green valleys far away, a 16-year-old boy became the king. And when he became the king, his name was Jigme Wangchuck, and this was 1972, and the country was Bhutan, which is a little kingdom in the Himalayas, which has been the model for Shangri-La. When Jigme Wangchuck became the king of Bhutan, he was asked by some reporter, "What will you do to increase your country's gross national product?" And he replied to the reporter, kind of off the cuff, but he just sort of said, "Well, as far as I'm concerned, gross national happiness is more important than gross national product." In Bhutan, they take the king seriously. So the king made this pronouncement and people started saying, "Yeah, gross national happiness, what's that?" Well, for the next four decades, essentially, Bhutan has tried to figure out what that means and to operationalize gross national happiness. It's now even in their constitution. The 2008 constitution of Bhutan says that the purpose of the government of Bhutan is to ensure gross national happiness. And that harkens back to Thomas Jefferson and the Declaration of Independence. It shouldn't be new for us. But anyway, they have brought the world's leading scientists, psychologists, all kinds of people to Bhutan to tell them what makes people happy and how they can improve happiness in their country. And as a result of that work, they've come up with 9 domains of happiness. And just to give you a few, these are things like social connection, cultural vitality, time balance, health, mental health, environmental, a good environment and access to nature, things like that. And they've begun to survey their population around these things and then create policy ideas and even policy tools that use these happiness domains to decide whether or not to pass this law or that law. Bhutan went so far, for example, as to consider whether or not to join the World Trade Organization and to subject that debate to its happiness policy tools. And when it did, Bhutan decided not to join the WTO.
And didn't Bhutan only bring television in a few years ago?
Actually, they brought it, in 1999, the last country in the world to have television. And they have some, doubts about whether it was the right decision.
I could have told them otherwise to
do it at all. But nonetheless, it's still somewhat restricted. They've actually, first they let it go wild, and then they've restricted it somewhat. But Bhutan faces many of the same problems and issues that all developing countries do. There's a great push for westernization, particularly in the cities. The kids are, wearing all the brand name clothes, and they're kind of caught up in this. And a wonderful Bhutanese movie called Travelers and Magicians is about this whole issue and about how a Bhutanese comes to terms with his being crazy about the West, but then realizing about how much his own country had to offer. So Bhutan is trying to find some kind of balance between how much Western development it allows and what it does to preserve its culture. And it's using these studies of happiness as the basis for figuring that out.
John DeGraff, editor of the Take Back Your Time Handbook. You're listening to A World of Possibilities. We'll return to our conversation with John after this short break. Stay with us.
We'd like to hear your thoughts about this program. Please write us at info@aworldofpossibilities.org.
Happiness runs in a circular motion. Thought is like a little boat upon the sea. Everybody is a part of everything anyway. You can have everything if you let yourself be. Happiness runs, happiness runs. Happiness runs, happiness runs. Happiness runs, happiness runs. Happiness runs, happiness runs. Happiness runs in a circular motion. Thought is like a little boat upon the sea. Everybody is a part of everything anyway. You can have everything if you let yourself see. Happiness runs, happiness runs. Happiness runs, happiness runs. Happiness runs, happiness runs. Happiness runs.
Welcome back to A World of Possibilities. I'm Mark Summer. Gross national happiness sounds a bit squishy, doesn't it? On the other hand, it's a bit more appealing to pursue happiness than product. Before our last break, John was describing Bhutan's studies of how to optimize happiness and how to measure and enhance a society's well-being. I asked him what made him think it was possible to bring such an airy concept from the eastern Himalayas to a brass tack city like Seattle, his hometown.
Well, we got real interesting about this because I went to Brazil in November and I gave a speech at the 5th International Gross National Happiness Conference at Iguazu Falls in Brazil. And there I met a fellow named Michael Panik, who is an epidemiologist with the Vancouver Island Health Authority in Victoria, British Columbia. Dr. Panik had gone to Bhutan and worked with the Bhutanese government to develop its surveys of happiness. He's a statistician as well as a population expert. And then he came back with that survey to Victoria with a shortened version, and he got a group of people to put together the Victoria Happiness Partnership. And you can Google that and find out about it. So they brought together all these kinds of groups from the city council to the University of Victoria to the United Way to various other organizations in the city of Victoria to create a partnership and to administer the survey in a scientific random sampling to over 2,000 citizens of Victoria, residents of Victoria. And the results were very, very interesting, and they are using those results to try to influence, to work on policy decisions with the city council, but also the partners are using it to try to improve their own internal practices so that they can make their workers, their employees, or their customers or clients or other people more satisfied as a result. So I get kind of excited about that. So shortly after I got back from Brazil, I happened to run into the president of the Seattle City Council, Richard Conlon, at a party. And Richard is someone that I know from the past. We got to talking and he asked me what I was doing and I told him about Brazil. And he said, well, that's interesting. Tell me more. I said, well, here's what I want you to do, Richard. I want you to bring this guy from Victoria down to speak to the Seattle City Council, and I want us to create a partnership in Seattle, a happiness partnership, do the same thing, create a survey, do the survey here, and then have a series of town meetings and things so we can discuss as a city what we can do that will improve well-being in the city. And, you know, Richard could have laughed me off, but he said, that's a great idea. So he went along with it. He told me that when he first brought it up to the city council, the eyes rolled. But they did bring Michael Panik down from Victoria. They put aside a little money for that, and they brought Michael Panik down to address the city council. And Richard told me after that, the city council was on board. People were really impressed when they saw what had actually been done and how serious it was. And then this June, early June, we brought Karma Chittam, who is the director of happiness, if you want, the minister of happiness.
Sounds like a social director.
Yeah. He's the director of the Gross National Happiness Commission of Bhutan. But he's the equivalent of a minister in the government. So we brought him to Seattle, wonderful guy. He addressed the Green Festival in Seattle. And then the next morning he came and talked to some members of the city council, not all, but several members of the city council. And then he and I went and spoke to the Environmental Protection Agency in Seattle. Then he went and spoke at a college. He did a whole bunch of other things while he was in Seattle. And it got a lot of interest in creating this partnership. So right now it looks like we have a very person who's very interested in funding this. The city council is on board. We're hoping to do the survey in the month of October, the scientific sampling in Seattle, announce the results in November. Early next year, start holding town meetings about this. And then probably in the late summer of 2011, we're going to have a regional conference on happiness in Seattle. And the city of Victoria has already told us they'll help pay for that. So we're excited about it.
I can just sort of hear the smirks from various listeners who are saying, oh, my God. It's John Vasconcellos and his Self-Esteem Commission of California. But how could this have happened in sober Seattle? But in a certain sense—
Well, you know, it's really not like that, though. This is very scientific stuff, and it's very— And what you find is that there's so much research out there on this subject right now. In the last year and a half, some 27,000 articles have been and books have been published concerning happiness, and many of these from leading scholars. We know a lot now about what makes people happy. The former president of Harvard, Derek Bach, has written a wonderful book called The Politics of Happiness, in which he looks at the research and suggests some of the kinds of programmatic steps that government could do that would actually improve, call it well-being if you want, don't call it gross national happiness, that might be off-putting to some people, but call it well-being. He's got lots of suggestions. And the other thing about this is that the other group of people who know how serious this really is, because they're trying to take it on and, in fact, nip it in the bud, they're trying to basically grab hold of it and hijack it, in my view, is the conservative right. So there are now two books, not just one, but two books by Arthur Brooks, who is the president of the American Enterprise Institute, the conservative think tank, on this subject. The first one is called, I'm not making this up, Gross National Happiness. And the second one, which is now a more popular book, which has been very strongly endorsed by such luminaries as Newt Gingrich and Karl Rove and Dick Cheney and so forth, is called The Battle. And it says it's about the coming battle for Americans' happiness. And it says what the conservatives are really about is improving happiness. And what Brooks argues, contrary to all of the social science that's out there, is that you get happiness by having the smallest government, lowest taxes, et cetera, et cetera. So the whole conservative agenda produces happiness. Well, the fact is that's couldn't be further from the truth. When the surveys of countries around the world are done, the highest scores for happiness are always in the countries like Denmark, Finland, the Netherlands, Sweden, all countries in which government plays an active role in people's lives, in which, in fact, Forbes magazine looked at the happiest countries of the world. And Bruce Bartlett, who's a conservative economist, was with the Reagan administration, wrote the piece in Forbes. And he said, well, you know, some people will say that these are the low taxes and small government make you happy, but the facts don't bear that out. In fact, what characterizes the world's happiest countries are three factors. Number one, they are the most egalitarian countries in the world. They have the smallest gap between rich and poor. Number two, they have the best work-life balance in the world, the shortest numbers of working hours, the more opportunity for people to have time. And number three, they have the world's highest taxes. Now, this is not la-la-la stuff. This is serious politics.
It's also serious economics. I was thinking just this morning as I was doing an interview with someone about the poverty of economics and as we know it, and the impoverishment of the whole economic conversation that goes on worldwide at the moment, because it is so intensely material, because it completely denies any other dimension to human beings. It's sort of economic man. It comes out of early industrial sort of theory. Are we still in an industrial world, or are we entering a world that is actually has to be based on a very different notion of economy that includes dimensions far removed from the material?
Well, it absolutely has to include those new dimensions, because we simply cannot continue on our present course in an environmental sense. We are already, if the rest of the world were to assume the American lifestyle, we'd need five planets. We know this. It would be ecological suicide to continue to grow materially in the rates that we have been doing. So we have to find our satisfaction in something other than stuff. And what these happiness studies show is that, in fact, that's where you do find satisfaction, that satisfaction is found in connection. It's found in generosity. It's found in useful work. It's found in time in nature. It's found in these kinds of things, not in simply piling up more and more stuff. The Bhutanese have shown this. All the scientific research shows this. So I think it's absolutely important that we think along those lines. And I'm currently the economic side matters very much to me because I'm currently in the process of writing a book which will be published by Bloomsbury Press next April or May called What's the Economy For Anyway? I got a contract. I have to have the manuscript in by the 1st of October, writing it with an ecological economist named Dave Batker. And we're looking at exactly these kind of things. How can we create an economy which serves what we think the purpose of the economy is? And that was described by Gifford Pinchot, the first director of the U.S. Forest Service, as the greatest good for the greatest number over the longest run. And so that's how we define it. We define the greatest good as quality of life. Some of that's about stuff, but only to a point. It's also about health. It's about people. It's about those kind of connections that make it. It's about happiness. The greatest number is about fairness, and it's about justice, and it's about opportunity for everybody in the society. Something we haven't thought much about in America in the last 30 years as we've become, you know, the least egalitarian country in the industrial world, and we've seen the gap between rich and poor widen into a chasm. And the third part, the longest run, is about sustainability. What are we going to leave for generations to come? So the greatest good for the greatest number over the longest run. In my view, that ought to be our economic agenda.
What I've always liked about the way you, there are a few things I've always appreciated about the way you approach your work. The first is that you have a light heart and a great sense of humor, in addition to compassion. The second is that you don't wholly politicize things. You find a way to speak about them and to understand them that goes down to sort of touches on our souls.
Well, I hope that's true, Mark. I appreciate your saying that. I definitely want to make things funny. I mean, you know, because I think that it's very important that we be able to do that to some degree, and we be able to laugh at some of these kind of things, because this stuff can get relentlessly grim, and unfortunately, that does not even. Though many of this grimness may be real, it doesn't necessarily persuade people about things that are positive and things that are better. We also need to understand that these may be the springboards and that can lead us to a different kind of life, a life that's slower, a life that's more relaxed, a life that's more about social connection and human connection and contribution and generosity and you know, instead of the ownership society or the you're on your ownership society, as I think it should be more aptly called, I believe in the we're all in it together society. And I think when we do that, we not only find that it's good for us economically, and it's good for us in terms of preventing some of the problems that we've seen and improving the environment and stuff, but it's also good for the heart and the spirit.
Thank you so much for stopping by, John.
Oh, the pleasure's mine, Mark. Keep up the good work.
Slow-mo man John DeGraff. For more information about Take Back Your Time, visit its website at timeday.org. You're listening to A World of Possibilities. When we return from this short break, we'll hear from Carl Honoré, author of the best-selling book In Praise of Slowness. This program is underwritten with support from listeners like you. Stay with us.
Take advantage of our many online resources, including podcasts and full-length guest interviews at aworldofpossibilities.org. We're also on Facebook and iTunes U.
In the late of the evening, with the cold in my eyes.
Welcome back. You're listening to A World of Possibilities, and I'm Mark Sommer. Unlike John DeGraff, author Carl Honoré wasn't born slow. He was cruising the fast lane when he collided with the realization that he was racing past all that really matters, heading who knows where and to what end. A recent convert to slow-mo, Carl isn't doctrinaire about his personal discovery. He grants that increasing speed in transportation, production, and the exchange of information have brought great benefits to humanity. But he believes they've also extracted a price in our relations with nature, one another, and ourselves, a price that's rising by the nanosecond. To learn more, we reached Carl at his office in London. I asked him what prompted him to slow the pace of his own life.
For me, the wake-up call came when I started reading bedtime stories to my son, and I used to find that I'd go into his bedroom at the end of the day and I just could not slow down. So I'd be sitting on the bed with one foot on the floor, speed reading Snow White, you know, jumping paragraphs and sometimes whole pages. And these tricks to speed things up never really work with kids, because of course my son knew the books inside out, and so he'd catch me out and he'd say, you know, Daddy, why are there only three dwarves in the story tonight? You know, what happened to Grumpy? What happened to Grumpy? And so we were constantly at loggerheads. And I knew from my own folk memory of being read to by my parents that this should have been the most relaxed, the most intimate, the most tender, the most magical moment of the day when a father sits down to read a story to his little boy. But in our house, it had become a battle of wills. It was a war between my speed and his slowness. And this went on for some time until I caught myself charging at full speed through an airport departure lounge, speed reading a newspaper article with time-saving tips with fast people like me to go even faster. And one of these tips talked about a series of books called The 1 Minute Bedtime Story, or, you know, Snow White in 60 Seconds. And I remember reading those words and thinking to myself, you know, hallelujah, what a great idea. I am going to get the whole set FedEx tomorrow from Amazon, you know, express delivery. But thankfully, I had a second reaction, and it's like when you're in the cartoons and the light bulb appears over your head, and I suddenly thought, whoa, you know, has it really come to this? Am I really in such a hurry that I'm prepared to fob off my son with a soundbite at the end of the day? And that was the wake-up moment for me. That was the turning point. That's when I suddenly realized that I'd just lost my bearings, and I wanted to make sense not only of my own speedaholism, but I wanted to pick apart and try and understand this general roadrunner culture that seems to have become the norm across the world. And that was the starting point for writing the book.
You know, it's funny you mention that. My daughter, actually, having a child late in life at age 48, that forced me to slow down, actually, because all of my work had to come to a stop and I became the house husband. And you know the way a small child is, they don't work in a world of time or appointments, and they command your attention. So I found that what I did was to surrender to her world, and that was a world of a kind of timeless zone that was incredibly relaxing. Did you allow yourself that time with your child or children?
Well, I think back then, when I was stuck in fast forward, I didn't, but I do now. And you've put your finger on something very central here, which is that magic that children are born with, that remarkable capacity to disappear into a moment. Children are not born with any conception of what we understand to be time or the digital clock. We inculcate those values in them in school through the primary years and so on. They have their own tempo and their own rhythm. And they expect us to fall into that and to move in lockstep with them. And when we don't, that's when things start to go wrong. And certainly one of the great gifts, I think, if we allow ourselves to be open to it, that children bring, is that other register, that other way of moving through time, that way of stepping out of time in a way and just being there, present in the moment and fully engaged with whatever you're doing or thinking or consuming or eating or making, rather than racing through every moment with one eye on the clock and the other eye on your inbox.
It's interesting, too. I remember Ram Dass, otherwise known as Richard Alpert, formerly of LSD fame, but in his later years, he got into the notion, in fact, he wrote a book called Be Here Now, which became something of a mantra for spiritual pilgrims in the 1970s. And we were all using various kinds of techniques, including meditation, to try to move out of both future and past and just live now. And it's amazingly difficult to do that. And I remember sitting in what's called Zazen, which is Zen meditation, most painfully sitting there in full lotus with my knees just cracking apart moment after moment and breaking through the impulse to stand up and run away and be distracted. And I recall reaching a point where I broke through. This was after 5 days or so of almost constant meditation, and where the resistance ended and I entered into the present moment with no other thoughts. And it was the most spacious place and time I've ever known. Have you experienced that sort of thing, whether in meditation or any other way?
I've had the same experience, and I went through the same uncomfortable and even painful transition that you've just described. I write about this in the book, where I went to a meditation retreat, and for the first 3 days, it was just agony trying to step out of roadrunner mode and be still, to disconnect completely and slow down. But as you've described it, you, if you stay with it, if you have the patience and the strength to hold on and to come out the other end, the place you come out is remarkable. I mean, it is a place of immense stillness and space and possibility. And it's something you hear, and we've heard, you know, for hundreds of years from people who practice meditation or move in cultures or religions that embrace that way of thinking. But it's a lesson, it seems to me, that in the 21st century we've forgotten, that we've just jettisoned as we've moved into this crazed frenzy of multitasking, where to be still, to be unplugged, to be quiet, to be slow, is almost seen as countercultural. It's seen as failure. It's seen as surrender. It's seen as heresy. And I think there's a basic human need for that change of gears, to be in that slow space, that place of quiet and stillness. And because so many people are denied it, I think that's one reason why there's such a strong feeling of existential malaise, but also health problems and troubles with relationships. I mean, we've tried to accelerate absolutely everything, from not only the way we work in the workplace, but even our personal relationships. I mean, people have 922 friends on Facebook, but when was the last time they actually spent a whole afternoon chatting with one of them in the park? So we end up in this curious worshiping of all things fast, and we seem to have swallowed the idea that faster is always better, when manifestly that's untrue. And I think that's why this whole slow culture quake has really caught the imagination and has spread so far and wide so quickly, ironically, that the slow revolution is growing fast is not surprising, because I think it speaks to a very profound and timeless human need, and that is the need to step off the turbocharged carousel and to find those other rhythms and those other tempos.
When you wrote that book, it seems to me that was around the time the slow food movement began in Italy. Tell us a little bit about the genesis of slow food and how it spread into, I don't know, slow sex and everything else.
Well, slow food emerged at the end of the 1980s. The spark was the arrival of McDonald's on the Spanish Steps in Rome, and to a lot of Italian gourmands, this was just a branch too far. And so they decided they had to do something about it. And so they set up slow food as a counterpoint to fast food, the idea being that slow food represents everything that fast food does not. It's about food that is cultivated and cooked and consumed at a slower pace. And it's about, you know, the art of eating well, and also how we farm the land and look after animals and so on. So it's not just about sitting around, you know, tables with white tablecloths and eating foie gras. It's much more less elitist and much more open than that. But the essential idea is that faster is not always better, and getting away from this idea of accelerating everything around food. And I would say that slow food, what it did was it recaptured and took back the word slow, because slow in our, particularly Western culture, has for a long time been a dirty word. It's a four-letter word. It's a byword for lazy and torpid and unproductive and Luddite and backward and all the things that nobody wants to be. And what slow food did, I think, was to say, okay, we are slow and we're proud of it. That slow is a good thing, and that slowness has a role to play in the 21st century, that slowness can be a virtue. And so what happened through the 90s, especially the late 90s, was that this notion of slower can be better, or that faster isn't always better, began to trickle out of the food sphere and attach itself to everything that we do. And I guess my book came along and said, became in a way the sort of manual for taking that very simple idea that slower can be better, that faster isn't always the best policy, and applied it and investigated how it could be applied in every sphere of life. So since slow food began gathering momentum through the early 90s and up to today, we've seen an explosion of other slow movements. So there are now slow movements for, you know, slow medicine, slow manufacturing, slow sex, slow parenting, slow education, slow design. Slow travel is huge in the tourism industry. Slow cities, you know, whatever you do, the idea, that very simple idea of slow, which is to do things at the right speed, that sometimes there are moments to be fast, sometimes there are moments to be slow. What musicians call the tempo giusto, the idea that every piece of music has a natural rhythm to it, a natural tempo, and if you can get as close as possible to that correct speed, that right tempo, then you will do whatever it is you're doing better and enjoy it more. And once you have that idea of doing everything not as fast as possible but as well as possible, you realize that it can apply to everything that you do. So this slow culture quake has really gathered extraordinary momentum over the last few years. And from a personal point of view, I'm just blown away by it. When I published my book, when it first came out, I thought that I would just be eviscerated, particularly by the business community. But the opposite was true, that it seemed to me that the book came along at just the right moment, where people were feeling that they were racing through their lives instead of actually living them. And there was a real sense that we had lost our compass as a culture, and that we had moved away from something very simple and essential, which was that idea of doing things well rather than doing them fast. And so I think the book came along at the right time, and the tectonic plates have been shifting below the surface for some time anyway, and I think we've just been moving closer and closer and with more and more conviction towards a slow world. I mean, we still have a long way to go. The slow revolution will be slow. It's not going to happen, you know, tomorrow morning or next year. But I've just seen some remarkable shifts in the last, especially with the credit crunch. I think that's focused minds as well. It seems to me that we're moving much more towards a consensus around the idea that slower can often be better.
Carl Honoré, author of In Praise of Slowness. You're listening to A World of Possibilities. We'll continue our conversation with Carl in just one leisurely moment. Stay tuned.
To receive a weekly podcast of this program, find us in the iTunes Store or follow the link at aworldofpossibilities.org.
Welcome back. This is A World of Possibilities, and I'm Mark Summer. The economic downturn has revived the long-lost low-cost arts of home cooking, gardening, staycations, and live conversations. Unemployment and underemployment are reversing the priorities of mainstream middle- and working-class Americans. With less money but more time, many are rediscovering the pleasures of non-monetary work and play. For author Carl Honoré, these are hopeful signs. Suddenly it's slow this, slow that, slow everything. Let's go into some of these, like slow cities, slow travel, and slow sex. I mean, and even slow money. There's a slow money movement now that's growing very rapidly. But let's look at, first of all, at slow travel. What do you mean by that?
Well, slow travel is a reaction against the, well, against the culture of fast travel, which had really taken hold in recent years. You know, the idea of flying to New York for lunch, or taking 3 days off, visiting Paris and seeing every single tourist site in those 3 days, and then returning home more exhausted than when you went in the first place. And I think slow travel is about getting back to slower, more gentle rhythms. You know, it can manifest itself in lots of different ways. It can imply actually traveling to your destination more slowly. So instead of hopping on a low-cost jet, you go by train, or you cycle, or maybe even walk, depending on where you're going. And then once you get there, you move away from that fast, superficial experience of a place. So instead of staying in the chain hotel and eating in the same sorts of restaurants and visiting the same sites with the same iPod talking tour in your ear as everyone else, you move off the beaten track. You stay maybe your whole holiday, your whole week in one place, and you plug into the local. Because one of the downsides of globalization is that it has rubbed away a lot of the rough edges. The world has flattened things out and taken away the fine grain and texture of our experience of things. And slow travel is about bringing back that fine grain, bringing back the local. So you would maybe go to Paris, and instead of charging off to see the Eiffel Tower, Notre Dame, and all of the cliched tourist sites, you maybe do a house swap and stay in an apartment in the 19th arrondissement, and you drink your coffee in the local cafe on the corner with the copy of the newspaper, watching the world go by, your children playing the local playground, you buy vegetables in the local market and cook them. You know, that's getting away from that fast approach to getting to know a place and getting to know it properly by getting to know it slowly. You know, moving towards the ungoogleable travel experience, I think, is one of the phrases that gets booted around now in travel conferences and tourism seminars. But essentially, it comes back to this slow idea that less is often more and that slower is often better, you know, quality before quantity. And if you apply that to travel, you get a lot more from your vacation. You get a lot more bang for your travel buck than if you're just charging through like a headless chicken.
Let's go to, I'm sure every listener is going to want to hear about this, slow sex. What could you possibly mean? I remember reading in your book about Tantra. What was your personal experience of Tantra and how that slows down and deepens the experience?
Well, what drove me to that was, as I was investigating this speed culture, it became obvious to me that sex had also been infected by the virus of hurry. And, I mean, you see it in so many ways now, don't you? The recent surveys of how we use our cell phones and smartphones and gadgets suggest that 20 to 25% of us routinely interrupt the act of lovemaking to answer the phone or read a text message or send a tweet. I mean, how does that even work? You know, hang on, honey, time out. I've got to tell my 321 followers that we're getting it on. And I thought that was ridiculous until I saw a newspaper headline, or no, it was a kind of lifestyle magazine front cover in my local news agent, and it had a headline that just stopped me in my tracks. It was "Bring her to orgasm in 30 seconds." So it's kind of like even in the bedroom, it's on your marks, get set, go. Sex is an Olympic sport, and I think the fact that people feel so, especially women, I think feel really shortchanged by that dash to the finish line approach to sex, that there's a lot of dissatisfaction around, and that's why this slow sex movement has taken off. And of course, what slow sex is doing is it's moving away from the idea of faster, of getting to the orgasm as quickly as possible, of jumping into bed instantly. It's about the slow burn. You know, it's about foreplay. It's about shutting off all of the gadgets and coming together completely in the moment with another person and allowing not only the body to warm up, especially the female body, to deliver more bang for your buck, but also all of those other subterranean connections that begin to flow when two people come together with the gadgets turned off and are in the moment completely, you know, the emotional, the psychological, the spiritual, the philosophical, all those things begin to happen as well. And, I mean, the slow sex movement is tapping into deeper movements that go back a long way. I mean, you mentioned Tantra or Taoist sex and so on. I mean, I did for the the book, I attended a tantra workshop, and it was unsettling at first because so much of the paraphernalia of tantra has a kind of new age ring to it, and that's not really my background at all, and I found it a little disconcerting to begin with. But once you sit with it for a while and get past that sort of that aspect of it, which a lot of people will love anyway, but I found it a little bit uncomfortable to begin with. But once you are there and you are there with your partner and you begin to shut out all of the noise and sound and fury of daily life, and you begin to be shown how to slow it down, how to caress again, how to listen, how to touch, how to breathe, and just those very simple things. I mean, this is not rocket science, but what's difficult for us in the 21st century, where we are so marinated in this culture of speed, is when we come to make love, we make love fast. And what I found the tantric workshop helped me do was to find that slower rhythm, that other gear. And you do realize pretty quickly that it works, you know, that it pays handsome dividends.
You know, it's interesting. I think part of this is also a matter of letting go of destinations and goals.
Absolutely.
Because that seems to be, more than anything else, what drives us towards trying to get to somewhere. And if you're not trying to get anywhere, but trying to just come into where you already are, then it seems to change your energy. And you seem to put all of that focus, instead of into something that you haven't yet reached, into something that's already who you are and where you are.
I think that's absolutely true. And that can apply in sex, but it applies in everything. The idea that you focus on the journey rather than the destination. And I think once you get your head around that, once you change the computer chip in your mind, if you like, and put the process ahead of the final result, get away from that management thinking, which is all about targets and timetables and results and numbers that you can put on graphs and spreadsheets and so on, then you have, I think, a deeper and richer experience of whatever it is you're doing. And of course, the delicious irony is that once you stop obsessing about the destination and you stop fixating on the results, you often end up with better results at a better destination. And this is the sort of glorious irony of it, is that, but when you start really investing yourself in the now, in the moment, in how you're doing something, in taking real pleasure and real pride in the process, in the journey, then I think you end up in a far more luminous and uplifting destination, whatever it is you're doing, whether you're talking about putting your company together or raising your children or whatever it is. I think that's that same principle applies, that if you focus on what you're doing rather than freaking out about where you're going to end up, then you'll end up somewhere much more fruitful.
Carl Honoré, author of In Praise of Slowness. Years ago, when my wife was pregnant with our daughter, all the sources of income on which I'd long relied disastrously dried up. My first reaction was near panic. But my wife went to work gardening while I took care of our newborn. We survived on very little, but these turned out to be the best years of my life. The chance to be with my daughter in those first years of self-discovery gave me access to small pleasures and boundless joys I'd never dreamt possible. Now a larger society is experiencing what some of us did even during boom times. Up to now, the slow movement has been largely confined to those with the leisure and means to afford to relax. But the Great Recession may drive a wider range of people to start exploring less frenetic ways of being and doing. Many Americans are enduring a painful downsizing, losing their jobs, their homes, their dignity. For some, resentment and a refusal to face facts is fueling a defiant pedal-to-the-metal mentality. But for many others, this deceleration is coming to be seen as a chance to slow down and savor simple pleasures that have been lost during generations of hot pursuit. The benefits, both personal and societal, are potentially enormous. As the Buddhists advise, don't just do something, sit there. I'm Mark Summer, and this has been A World of Possibilities. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to A World of Possibilities. We invite you to access the full interviews with our guests, subscribe to our podcast, and discuss today's program on Facebook. just go to aworldofpossibilities.org. Your host and executive producer is Mark Sommer. The recording engineer is Mike Schwartz. The associate producers are Naeem Edidi and Matt Fiddler. The senior producer is Greg McVicker. And I'm Gabriela Castellan. Thanks for listening.